session number 28897, Reel 4.
My impression of the Australian relationship between officers and men is that they were basically at home from the same rank. They were often mates in civilian life and treated one another as mates in army life, in Air Force, Navy life. Yeah. Is that something you experienced?
Yes, at Reel. I think there wasn't that sort of traditional upper class attachment to our officers. Some of them had come from just ordinary ranks, you know, and there wasn't the same feeling as what there was in the UK at that time, where a lot of the officers came from probably more privileged surroundings than what I did, anyhow. No, we didn't have any trouble. Yes, certainly we probably had more trouble with one of our drill instructors than anybody, and he was just a corporal, but of course his job was to ball us out, so that's what he did. I think probably there is a difference in attitude with Australians and what there was in Britain.
We can talk about some of that later on too, and I'll be interested to talk to you about things like camaraderie that you would experience, and particularly obviously when mates were not returning back from missions. But following the Panama Canal experience, presumably you're heading off, your first port of call after that would have been America.
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, we went to New York, and it was good. Actually, on the way up to New York, let me just mention the other side of the Panama Canal. You come into the Caribbean. Now, the Caribbean at the other side of the on the eastern side of the Panama Canal, we came out into the Caribbean, and the Caribbean was a bit of a hunting ground for U-boats in those days, because they knew that most of the ships that were going went through the Panama. They couldn't go right around the bottom, the Cape Horn, is it? They came out into the Caribbean. Well, when we got into the Caribbean, the captain started to zigzag the ship, and also our submarine watch was stepped up. We had to do a lot of submarine watch through there, and he zigzagged the ship. You could just see the zigzagging happening all the time, because we were a bit conscious, of course, in those days. And also, one interesting thing that happened was that we were towing paravanes, they called them. They were quite like big steel cylinders, they looked to be, and they were towed on chains or hawsers from the bow of the ship. And they were towed along parallel to the ship. They must have been designed so that they would do that. And we knew that they were something to do with submarines and mines. Apparently, if you hit a mine, the mine would slide down these chains, and there was an explosive bolt or something that would cut it off. That's what we were told, anyhow. Well, we weren't told much at the time, but I've questioned a few Navy blokes since the war about these things. And I don't know whether that was commonly done, but we had them at any rate, zigzagging through the Caribbean. And we went straight up to New York. Started to snow just before we got to New York. We were going from tropics into the north. And of course, all the West Australians there had never seen snow in their life. So we started to make snowballs and snowmen and have snow fights. And we had some pretty sophisticated people on board the ship, and they thought we were a lot of idiots. And they were most amused with all this, because Europeans returning home, you know. And we got to New York, and we were in New York about January and February, I think. We must have had Christmas somewhere along the line. I don't know where it was. It could have been in New Zealand, but I don't remember Christmas at all that time. Of course, we crossed the equator, and we had some sort of a do then too once, but I can't remember much about that either. And the Americans, they'd done a little bit of homework, and they knew that we called girls Sheilas, and they knew that we said Dinkum and a few other things like this, and they started to talk about our girls as Sheilas and stuff. But they also knew that most of the pop songs of the period were coming from America in those days, out here at any rate. And so we went around to, I think it was Fred Waring that had an orchestra. We were entertained by these orchestras, and they put on dances for us, very, very controlled dances. There was no way you could attach yourself to one of the girls or anything like that. We were taken there and taken back to the ship. But they were very good to us. And I had developed a carbuncle on my neck here, and it was really sore. And the medic on the ship used to put iodine on it, and he said, the first thing you want to do when you get ashore is go and see a doctor and get this thing lanced. It was giving me curry, you see. Matter of fact, I've still got a little photograph of our pass that we had to get in to get into the United States, and I can see all this cotton wool that was over this carbuncle. And so while we were there, I was able to see an American doctor, and he lanced it, and I was much relieved at that. And he said to me, "I see by your wings, Ozzy, that you're an Australian pilot." And I said, "Yes, doctor." He said, "Well, how many Japs have you shot down?" So I had to tell him that I'd only just qualified and hadn't been on operations. But we had a bit of a chat and discussed the war a bit. I can't remember the details. Then at the end he said, "Okay, lad." He said, "There's no charge for my services. Good luck to you." And so off I went.
Well, my impression too is that the Americans really looked up to the Australian soldier, the Australian airman in this case.
Yeah. Well, they seemed to. They seemed to, you know, they treated us very well indeed. And they had a place that was called the Welcoming Committee for the Fighting Services of Australia and New Zealand, or some sort of such title close to that anyhow. And that was where I was able to make the appointment to see the doctor. And they looked after us well. We went to all sorts of things. And then we had a couple of free days while the ship was loading up again or something. I don't know what the ship was doing, really. Incidentally, when we went into New York Harbour, of course, we went past the Statue of Liberty, and we berthed in a berth just adjacent to the berth where the Normandy... You remember the Normandy ship? I think it had won some races across the Atlantic before the war. One of the biggest ships going at the time, and it had been sabotaged, and it was lying on its side in this harbour in New York. I remember that quite well. At any rate,
what were your impressions of the city, of New York at the time?
Well, it was covered in snow at the time, and there were bulldozers and all sorts of machines that we'd never even imagined sweeping up the streets and so forth, and it was icy cold. And of course the high-rise buildings, we only had one high-rise building in Perth, I think, in those days, and that was the old CML, which it looked like
about
a door.
Six stories high.
Not much more. And so we'd heard all about this famous what's it called? The Empire State Building. And so we decided we'd go up it. There were stories getting around that it swayed in the wind and the lifts shot up like rockets. So, of course, we had to see this. So we went there and hopped in a lift. And they did go up quickly, but our lifts these days, of course, go up that quick as well. But compared with the old lifts that used to go, it was very fast. And it was very high, of course, and you got a beautiful view from the top. There's a walking area at the top of it. And there were thousands of signatures on the... It was a sort of, from my memory, it looked like an aluminium type a dome or something. And there were thousands of signatures on there for people that had been up, whether it was put there for that or not. But anyway, our signatures went on it as well. And I've often wondered since whether we were just vandals or whether that's what it was for. But we didn't notice the building swaying much, but possibly they did minimally. I mean, you can hear the bridge down there, Stirling Bridge there, if it gets the traffic on it, that moves like that a bit. So maybe those really high buildings do flex a bit. But it was such a novelty in those days to go up there. They're about the main things that I remember about New York, I think. I was impressed with the size of it. I think I wrote and told my mother it was pretty cold and not as nice as Perth, something like that, you know. Being a bit homesick, maybe. Don't know. But, yes, they gave us a good time, the Americans. I must admit that. And then we went down to the ship, and this is where we really got into the war zone. Well, the Caribbean was a war zone too, so we'd really got into the war zone there.
They had U-boats up the Mississippi. At one point.
Oh, did they?
So they were all around there. It was quite a dangerous place.
Yes.
How was the security on ship?
It was pretty strict. Yes, getting in and off, you mean? Yes. Well, we were picked up, and we weren't allowed to roam around too loosely. I can't remember what happened on the days when we were able to get away, but you certainly wouldn't have been able to get on the ship.
But presumably at sea there were precautions that you had to take too.
Well, on the ring,
no smoking on deck, no portholes open, no lights at night.
Yes, probably. I don't recall all that really very much. No portholes. I've got a little anecdote about that too later on. Yes, well, we got onto the ship. Eventually, they called us up and told us that all leave was cancelled and that we were going to sail out. And of course, the Atlantic in those days was a really dangerous place. I think at the time we went across, I've read reports since that there were about 1,600 vessels had been sunk in the period, you know, since the war had started up till then. And of course, we used to get a bit of information about poor blokes swimming around in burning oil, and it was a terrible business, really. So we wondered what was going to happen to us on this trip across to the UK. And I think I felt a bit apprehensive in a way. But at any rate, when we sailed out, all of a sudden we saw dozens and dozens of other ships all sort of converging into one big pattern. And then the British warships came in. I suppose they were destroyers or something, and came in and weaved in amongst us and so forth. So we realised then that we were in convoy. And
that must have been a pretty impressive thing to see.
It was very impressive. Yes, that really really impressed us. And when we saw the warships and all these other ships, we felt a bit more secure than we had initially when we were going out into the Atlantic on our own. We couldn't have gone far out, I don't think, before we picked up all these people. And then we were told that it was an 8-knot convoy. We had to go slow so that the slowest ships could keep up with us. Another reason we had to go slow was I think there, a lot of them were coal burners, and they used to belch out a fair bit of smoke, and they didn't belch out quite so much smoke if they went slow. This is what we're told, the smoke could have been a giveaway for the U-boats, you see. And also the fact that there were warships with us reassured us. And so away we set across the Atlantic, and of course it was blackout all round, yes. It was certainly blackout. And we had to do our 2 hours nighttime submarine watch. Well, it was so dark out in the Atlantic that you couldn't even see the rail along the edge of the ship, never mind about a submarine. But I suppose if submarine had come up and started firing, you might have seen something then. We got into a tremendous storm. But at one stage we did see some explosions on the periphery of the convoy, and it looked to me as though there were fires out there, but we were told nothing, and we don't know whether anything went down or what, but I'm sure there was a bit of U-boat activity there at one stage. And then the Atlantic can be very wild, as we found. And we got into a really violent storm on the way across, and the room, the big open space, sort of a lounge, I suppose you'd call it, where we used to play cards and everything, there was a piano in there, and there were tables, and we used to all play cards and talk and so forth and have sing-songs around the piano. Everything broke loose. The ship went over so quick, so steep once, excuse me, that all the furniture and the piano and everything broke loose. And there we were all sliding up and down for about 3 or 4 rolls, I think it was, with the piano and all the tables and chairs, they'd broken loose. I think they might have had something holding them, but they'd all broke anyhow. And so we all went across like that. And funnily, well, not funnily enough, but strangely enough, there was only one broken arm out of it, and lots of cuts and bruises and things, and I slid up and down there and didn't get hurt. So I was still having a bit of luck. And talking about portholes, there were some of the chaps were downstairs down in the cabins in this storm, because they were pretty seedy, and they were in on their bunk.
The
chaps were pretty seedy, seasick, you know, and they were lying in the cabins down there. And one of the portholes on one of these rolls, one of the portholes smashed through, and the water just poured in as though it was coming out of a hose. And frightened hell out of the boys. They thought that we'd been torpedoed, you see, so they soon lost their seasickness. They were out of bed and upstairs very quickly. But at any rate, the roll decreased gradually after that, and this porthole was actually well above the surface of the water, but because of the roll, this is what had happened. It must have been a big wave that hit it. And so they repaired it fairly soon, and everybody thought it was a great joke, I think, in the end. In hindsight, I didn't think it was much of a joke at the time. But it was freezing cold on these submarine watches, and after the storm, we woke up one morning, and the ship was still just chugging along still. Oh, incidentally, too, one thing I noticed, when the ship pitched, it pitched so much that when the stern came up, must have been practically out of the water because the propellers used to vibrate like mad, you know. And so that's how much it was pitching. And all of a sudden it was woke up one morning and the ship was as steady as a rock. And we walked up onto the deck and Tommy, well, I had to go on the deck that morning, that's what it was. And Tommy Scotland, one of my friends, I always used to relieve him on submarine watch. He said to me, "George, can you hear that bumping? What do you reckon that bumping is?" And I remember saying to him, "I'm so cold, Tom, I couldn't imagine what it is." And he said, "Well, have a look over the side." And I had a look over the side, and we were in an ice pack. As far as you could see, there were just blocks of ice. And we had an educated guess, I suppose that you'd call it, had realised we were sailing north, towards the north, at any rate, in the north easterly direction, I suppose. And there we were in this ice pack. And so went from one contrast to the other. And then a very thick fog enveloped us. And the ships really slowed down. And I remember thinking, you know, I hope this fog keeps the U-boats away, but I hope we don't run into one of those other ships in the fog too. I don't know whether I was a bit of imaginative or not, but at any rate, we sailed along through these ice packs, so we must have been fairly well up north to get into that.
Were you being instructed in things like lifeboat drill and yes, being forced to wear your life jackets and so forth?
We had a bit of that, yes. We had lifeboat drill, and I think we had to assemble, you know, on the mark and so forth. But I don't remember a lot about it, and I can't remember that we wore life jackets, but we may have done. I know Jean and I went over to England after the war in a ship, and that was common practice just in civil life, so I'm sure we must have had it, but it's not something that's stuck in my mind very much. Being in the cold on the submarine watch was the bit that stuck in my mind, and the big storm, and then the ice packs, and the explosions on the edge of the convoy. And then the fog. And then the next big impression I've got is going down between the UK and Ireland, and down the Irish Sea. And once we got into the channel between the two, is that the Irish Sea there? Yeah. The warships that were with us started to come in and weave around. And they had loudspeakers, and they were playing martial music over them, sort of celebrating the success of the convoy, I suppose. And that was really exciting. We all gathered on the rail of the ships, and we were ecstatic to know where we were. And then we went into Bristol, I suppose it was, wasn't it? Yeah, Bristol. And got off the ship in our, with all our kit and stuff, and that was really exciting too, to arrive in the UK, because we'd read so much about the UK battling and the bombing and all this sort of thing. And we had to go on a march. I think they must have picked us up in trucks or something, and I can't remember the details, but I do remember marching along to catch a train in Bristol, and there was an old chap standing beside the road. He had a bowler hat on, and he had World War I medals on, and he was just standing at the side of the road, and we were all marching, trying to march decently. I don't know how good it was, but he took his hat off as we went past and put it over his chest, as much as to say, "Thanks for coming to give us a hand." And I've never forgotten that.